Something wasn't right. Red flags. Only I got it all mixed up. Terrence was quiet, and then he said, "This is a weird question, but are those Nico's shoes?" He'd forgotten. "Oh, God. Yes. I'm sorry. Do you mind?" "No, it's fine. I mean, maybe you could leave them by the door, actually. I just don't want germs tracked in." Yale slipped them off, put them on the welcome mat, and then he washed his hands, even though he'd already done it after changing Roscoe's litter. He said, "Tomorrow before I leave, I'll run errands for you, okay?" "Yeah." Yale lay on the couch that night, listening as Terrence tossed in his sheets, as he whimpered through his night sweats. Yale closed his eyes and watched himself, the night of the memorial, from high up in Richard's house near the skylight. He watched himself talk to Fiona, talk to Julian, sip his Cuba Libre. Again and again, he watched himself take in the beginning of the slideshow, then turn and put his feet on the first step. He watched himself climb the stairs. 2015. Fiona woke up late. Not with a hangover, but with a raw throat that was already spreading its ache into her chest and sinus. Her hand flashed with pain every time her heart beat. Serge took her to his doctor in a cab. No appointment required. No insurance either. And the doctor swabbed her with iodine and bandaged her up sleekly and gave her pain pills and a prescription for an antibiotic. The bill was 23 euros, which Serge insisted on paying. "You take the day off," he said. "Promise, okay? You feel like going out, maybe you come to Richard's studio and he give you a tour. He can show you the videos on his computer, so you see before the show." But Fiona couldn't do that. Not yet. Watching this footage was a great thing to do tomorrow, but not today. Never today. She could take a few hours off, though, as defeating as the notion was. She could wait for Arnaud to call, see how sleepy these pills were going to make her. If Claire wasn't even in Paris, it made more sense to search online for Kurt Pierce plus arrest plus Paris. Fruitless. And how to move to France, American citizen. Semi-informative. And Hosanna Collective Paris. Also fruitless. Than to wander the streets. When Serge took off for the studio, she told him she was too tired. It was chilly out, but she opened the balcony doors, dragged a chair over, and listened to the sounds of the film crew. If she angled herself right, she could see the crowd, the lighting fixtures, the crane. She'd need to learn the movie's name before she left town, so she could see this thing when it came out. But she had no idea how long she'd be staying, or what her next step even was. She held on her lap the book of Paris history she'd bought. She was too distracted to read, but the photos were lovely, evocative. Women with fur stoles, men crossing a flood by stepping across cafe chairs, a nightclub entrance made to look like a monster's gaping mouth. She remembered what Nora had said once. "For us, Paris wasn't even Paris. It was all a projection. It was whatever we needed it to be." This conversation had happened at the wedding where she'd told Nora to get in touch with Yale, where she'd written down Yale Tishman Northwestern Brig on a cocktail napkin. It was her cousin Melanie's wedding, north of Milwaukee, and Melanie had specifically invited Nico and Fiona, but not their parents. She didn't include Terrence. It would have been a step too far, maybe, for 1985 Wisconsin, but her loyalty was to her own generation. Fiona and her brother had walked in together, like dates. Nico had lost weight, but Fiona thought nothing of it. He danced with Fiona, and he danced with the bride, and with their terrible cousin Deborah, and he sat and entertained Nora. In his car on the way home, he rolled up the side of his shirt to show her a stripe of vicious red bumps, ones that made Fiona's eyes water. "It's shingles," he said. And when she freaked out, he said, "It itches like hell, but it's the same thing as chickenpox. Anyone who ever had chickenpox can get it. The virus lives under your skin forever." He hadn't been to his own doctor, she learned later, just to the ER, where they'd given him calamine lotion and a leaflet. A month later, he and Terence were shopping, and Terence asked how much cash he had, and Nico spent a long minute staring at the $10 bill in one hand, the $5 bill in the other hand, unable to add them together. And 6 weeks after that, he was gone. She looked at the pigeon that had landed on the balcony rail. She was not ready to look at Richard's videos, but maybe she could work her way there by looking through Richard's photo albums. She closed the balcony, poured a glass of milk, took a few deep breaths. There were probably 20 albums on the shelf. A fact Fiona hadn't absorbed that first day. Rows of black leather, brown leather, colored canvas. Boxes full of slides as well, but she wouldn't mess with those. When she pulled a thick red album off the shelf, though, a paper slipped out and landed on the floor. Fiona attempted to clutch the album closed before anything else fell, but she dropped the whole thing, and now there were papers everywhere. Cream-colored sheets folded in half, small cards, a lavender page with a grainy photo of a man. They were funeral bulletins and prayer cards. She got on her knees and started stacking them up. This wasn't a photo album at all, she saw when she opened it to an old clipping from Out Loud Chicago, an obituary of someone who danced with the Alvin Ailey Theater. Jesus. She opened the album at the beginning and tried to slide the papers back into the empty spots. A man named Oscar, no one she remembered, had died in 1984. A clipping about Katsu Tatami from 1986. Here was the bulletin for Terence Robinson, Nico's Terence. How odd. She must have put this bulletin together herself, but she didn't remember it. Jonathan Bird, Dwight Sumner. There were so many of them, so impossibly many. In her current life, it happened at least once a week that someone would wander into the store and then, when they discovered its mission, say something like, "Oh, I remember that time." Fiona had learned to check her temper, to push her toes into the floor so her face didn't change. "I knew someone whose cousin had it," they'd continue. "Did you ever see Philadelphia?" And they'd shake their heads in dismay. And how could she answer? They meant well, all of them. How could she explain that this city was a graveyard? That they were walking every day through streets where there had been a Holocaust? A mass murder of neglect and antipathy? That when they stepped through a pocket of cold air, didn't they understand it was a ghost? It was a boy the world had spat out. Here, in her hand, a stack of ghosts. She looked through Terence's bulletin. They'd read a psalm, apparently, although the book and verse numbers didn't mean anything to her now. Asher Glass had sung. She remembered that. Asher would speak at ACT UP meetings with a voice like a politician from a black-and-white movie. He'd break into city council with his bloody handprint banner. He and his friend chained themselves to Governor Thompson's fence one summer, got arrested for the millionth time. Asher was still around, Fiona knew, living in New York. She'd seen him in a documentary a while back, a Three Decades of AIDS thing. He looked as healthy as anyone. Was so muscular you couldn't believe he had the same virus she'd seen carve men into skeletons. His hair had grayed, and he had jowls. And surely he was dealing with early osteoporosis, or the other landmines of being HIV positive over age 50. But in that movie, he'd looked ready to jump through the screen into Fiona's living room to help her lift boxes. It wasn't true, what she'd said. They weren't all dead. Not all of them. On October 13th, she'd held her own quiet memorial, alone in her house, for Nico. Candles and music, and too much wine. 30 years. How could it possibly have been 30 years? But that was just the start of the worst time. when the entire city she'd known was turning into lesions and echoing coughs and the ropey fossils of limbs. And although it made no sense at all, she'd never fully been able to shake the ridiculous, narcissistic feeling that the whole epidemic was somehow her fault. If she hadn't mothered Nico, she'd recently whined this at her therapist, if she hadn't taken care of him in those early years, brought him his allergy medicine on the L, let him see that she was doing all right, wouldn't he have gone home sooner or later? Vowed to date girls? He'd have been miserable, but it wouldn't have lasted long. A couple more unpleasant years at home, like every other gay man on the planet. And maybe he wouldn't have been exposed. He wouldn't have died. She had so much guilt about so many of them. The ones she wished she'd talked into getting tested sooner. The ones she might have gone back in time to keep from going out on a particular night. "Let's agree that we know this is illogical," her shrink said. The ones she might have done more for when they got sick. The night that, for no reason, she'd told Charlie Keene that Yale was with Teddy. Why on earth had she done that? It was an honest, drunken mistake, but everyone knew what Freud said about mistakes. She felt sometimes like some horrible Hindu god, turning all she touched to ash. The painkillers were making her swimmy. She could stay here, with this paper graveyard, and who knew what other landmines Richard's shelf contained. Or, right now, maybe a 10-minute walk away, there was footage of Nico she could look at. Nico alive. She was terrified. It would be so much stranger than a still photo. Was there sound? When was the last time she'd heard Nico's voice? When he was alive, she figured. If anyone had ever taped him, well, that would have been Richard. These would be the tapes. She had to do it. Serge had told her the corner for the studio, but she hadn't paid attention to the street number. And it wasn't like Richard had a sign out front. Fiona looked at the doorways, the storefronts, as if she could figure it out by squinting. Nothing looked right. Was she glad? She found herself at least partly relieved. And then she spotted Serge's motorbike parked on the broad sidewalk, propped against the wall of a building. She steeled herself and said, "Okay, then." She felt her phone before she heard it. "Yes?" She was shouting, and she didn't care. She plugged her other ear.
"Hey, calm down,"
Arno said.
"I'm calm. What?"
"Can you get to Le Marais? I think we have a couple hours."
She spun around to look for a cab. If nothing else, this timing was a sign, wasn't it? She wasn't meant to go in there and dwell on the past. She was here for Claire, not Nico. She left Richard's studio behind like it was on fire. 1986. Yale nearly forgot to go into work the next day. He'd somehow believed that it was Saturday, that after he went to the grocery store and the GNC for Terrence, after he packed up and tiptoed out of the apartment, all he had on his agenda was finding a place to stay tonight, maybe buying a clean shirt. But at 10 o'clock, walking down Halstead with a headache, he saw a guy in a necktie and realized it was Friday. At least it gave him somewhere to be. He already had his overnight bag, so he just got on the L. His clothes wrinkled from Terrence's couch. As the doors closed, someone came running at them, as if he'd fit through the inch of space left. He stood there, desolate, as the train pulled away. A thin man with dark hair. Yale thought for a moment that it was Julian, but that wasn't his chin, and Julian wouldn't be up yet at 10 in the morning. Yale wondered what he'd do if and when he ran into Julian. Would he hit him in the face, or embrace him? It wasn't Julian he was mad at, somehow. It was only Charlie. Halfway to Evanston, he decided that if he saw Julian, he'd probably just cry on him. Roman was already in Yale's office, collating and labeling the copies he'd made in Door County at the library. The entire contents of the shoebox. two messages from Bill Lindsay on his desk. One saying the Sharps were coming after lunch to see the pieces, the other reading, "Campo said yes, thank you." It took Yale a few slow seconds to remember that he'd given Richard Campo's number to Bill in the car yesterday morning, suggesting he could shoot the 8x10 photos they needed to send to New York, that maybe he'd do it on the cheap. Yale went into the restroom to shave and brush his teeth. He hadn't done it at Terrence's, because Terrence was curled on the bathroom floor by the time he woke up. And again, or maybe still, when he got back from his errands. Terrence had promised he'd be fine, that Asher was coming by later. Yale sprinkled water on his shirt now to iron out the wrinkles by hand. Maybe the test was wrong. Wasn't it possible to mix up the files? There were no names on any tests, just, what, numbers? Codes? So the code could be off, which still left him with the fact that Charlie was a louse and he himself was a fool. But all that would seem like nothing if the results could somehow be undone. And the test was so new. Teddy was always saying he didn't believe everyone with the virus would get the full-blown disease. It was part of some larger conspiracy theory Yale couldn't remember the details of. Something about there being no longitudinal studies. Christ, was this the bargaining stage of grief? But he hadn't even moved on from anger yet. He looked at his face in the mirror, crumpled like a child's portrait of a sucker. Back at his desk, he stared at papers he couldn't read. He hadn't eaten since breakfast the day before in Sturgeon Bay, not counting his liquid dinner last night. He should have bought himself a banana when he'd picked up Terrence's groceries. If he was infected, the best thing he could do was gorge, get fat while he still could. Eat 6 burgers tonight. Maybe by dinner he'd magically have an appetite. But where was he even going to eat dinner? Some miserable restaurant. And then what? He couldn't put Terrence out again. And he couldn't go anywhere they would ask questions. He thought of Richard's house, that big guest room. But the thought of that house made his stomach clench. Once upon a time, he might have stayed at Nico's. Maybe his apartment was still empty, unrented. But where was the key? There were old friends from the Art Institute, some who didn't even know Charlie, but no one he could impose on. He felt ill. Feverish, dizzy, an ache in his joints. He'd reminded himself when he woke up this morning that he would probably convince himself he was sick. Knowing this didn't help much. At noon, he slowly dialed his own number. He imagined Charlie had gone into work. Charlie would work through a tornado. But he thought maybe Teresa would pick up, could give him more answers. Really, no, it wasn't that. He wanted to cry at her. Wanted her to tell him everything would be okay. If Teresa picked up, he'd send Roman out of the office. But she didn't. And they didn't have an answering machine, because Charlie was convinced that the day they got one, it would be filled with panicked messages from his staffers. He called Out Loud Chicago. And, in a voice he hoped didn't sound like his own, but wasn't odd enough to attract Roman's attention from across the room, asked if the publisher happened to be in today.
"No,"
said a young person Yale couldn't identify. "Mr. Keene is out on personal business." He tried the travel agency, too, and was told that Charlie would be in on Tuesday. It was a tremendous relief when 1 o'clock hit. He had something to do now, a script to recite. When he got to Bill's office, the Sharps weren't there, but Richard already was. Yale hadn't heard him come in. Had he been asleep? He felt like maybe he had. Richard wore all black, except for the yellow sweater he'd knotted around his shoulders, and he moved like a cat around the room, crouching low to adjust the lights he'd brought. He had the Fujita green dress watercolor laid out on Bill's table.
"The man of the hour," he said, and blew a kiss at Yale before turning back to his lights.
Yale managed to say, "Thanks for doing this." He tried to remember if he'd seen Richard since the night of the memorial. Yes, several times. At the fundraiser, for instance. Still, Richard seemed to have walked straight out of Yale's nightmares.
The man had done nothing wrong. He'd thrown a great party. He'd made a beautiful slideshow. Richard didn't talk as he worked, didn't require Yale's conversation, and soon the Sharps were in the doorway, grinning like parents about to meet their adopted child. Bill made introductions. Esme, Alan, Richard Campo, Alan, Esme, and shut the door behind them all. He said, "Truly, this is the most extraordinary find of my career, and I can say right now that I'll retire happy. We could get this up next fall, is what I'm hoping. Well, maybe that's a bit optimistic. But a spectacular show." Bill showed them the Fujita, still on the table. "That's her," Yale said. "That's Nora."
"She's lovely."
Esme leaned over the paper, entranced. Bill opened the cover of the giant portfolio he'd moved the smaller pieces to, and Esme held her husband's arm. Richard looked, too, from behind. Yale said to him quietly, "It's Nico and Fiona's great aunt." The portfolio was open to one of the blue crayon Modiglianis, not that it looked much like anyone at all. Richard laughed, delighted. "Spectacular genes in that family." Maybe he could ask Richard, after all, for a bed tonight. A different bed. Would that be so terrible? Alan said, "I don't want to wake up and find I've invested in restoring some frauds." "Well," Yale said, "we could hold off till authentication comes through." His voice was made of tin. "But we have strong corroboration for provenance, and we'd love to get restoration started to prevent further damage." A painting was a thing to which you could prevent further damage. You could restore it, protect it, hang it on a wall. Bill looked at Yale expectantly. There was something else he was supposed to say, but he was blank. Bill cleared his throat and said, "One option is we could wait for the first authentication to come through. Let's say the Passin people verify his work, for instance." He flipped the nude Passin sketch. "Wouldn't that reassure us about the rest as well?" Alan bobbled his head side to side, noncommittal. Bill said, "Well, go get Roman. Go get the copies." And so Yale did. And as Richard continued working at Bill's desk, the rest of them gathered around the chair where Roman deposited the stack of papers. Yale half-listened as Roman read them a letter Nora had written home about Soutine and his wretched table manners. Bill, meanwhile, had come up behind Richard, who was putting white gloves back on, ready to pull one of Ranko Novak's cows out of the portfolio. Bill whispered, "Not those." It wasn't as if there were some Ranko Novak expert out there to mail the photos to. Bill said, "The artist was not overburdened with skill." The cow sketches weren't bad, but the three were nearly identical, and there was something too neat and too simple about them, like images from a How to Draw Animals book for kids. Still, Yale didn't fully understand Bill's contempt. Well, no one ever got to be a gallery director through egalitarianism. Richard shrugged, turned carefully to the first Metzinger sketch. Alan looked agitated, a scratch behind his ear. He said, "Look, what I'm thinking of those fake heads they found in the river. The summer before last, someone had dredged a canal in Italy, hoping to find the carved heads Modigliani had allegedly thrown there in his youth after a harsh critique from friends. They found three heads and rushed to display them, but a few weeks later, some university students came forward to say they had carved the pieces themselves and tossed them into the river as a prank." Bill took the letter Roman had been reading from, put it back on the stack, kept his hand there. "It's true everyone's hackles are up. There's a high bar to clear, for Modigliani in particular. But listen, we're tremendously confident. The point is, authentication could take ages. And why not get things moving?" Out of nowhere, Yale was frozen by the memory of Charlie and Julian driving down to a protest in Springfield that summer. Charlie said there were other people in Julian's car, but Yale hadn't seen that himself.
They said they were staying with some National Gay Task Force people. They said they didn't get arrested at the protest, but that Julian got a speeding ticket. Yale looked over at Esme, who was watching Richard work, standing back so she wouldn't make a shadow on the art. He could see from her face, the way she leaned over the Metzinger sketches as if she wanted to dive in, that she was sold on the whole thing. The story, the collection, the exhibit. Esme said, "How did she go from art student to model? I'm only asking because weren't the models, you know, ladies of the night?" Yale said, "We'll be going back up to Wisconsin, getting the whole narrative." And yes, that was where he could go. Not tonight, but soon. He could stay up there. He could drag it out. He could leave this city, keep driving north, put a great, frozen expanse between himself and Charlie. Bill said, "What do you think? This is the Lerner Sharp collection." Alan drew a deep breath. He said, "We trust your instincts, both of you." Yale doubted anyone should follow him anywhere, since he was himself the world's biggest fool. But he nodded. "You won't regret it," he said. Back in Yale's own office, Roman stared at him expectantly, a border collie awaiting command. Yale said, "It's been a long week. I'll see you Monday." He thought, as Roman walked out the door with his backpack hanging by one strap, of calling after him to ask if he had a spare futon. But that was just sad. He couldn't handle his intern looking at him with pity. He tried calling home two more times, and no one picked up. Maybe Teresa had taken Charlie to the doctor, or maybe he was lying in bed listening to the phone ring. Time passed strangely. 5 minutes spent staring at his empty bookshelves took around 5 years of psychic time, while the 20 minutes he spent talking to Donna the docent out in the gallery flew by too fast. And then he was at his desk again, staring at infinity. Richard poked his head in after he'd finished. He grinned and whispered, "He doesn't remember me."
"Who?"
"That old queen. Your boss. He used to skulk around the snake pit 8, 10 years ago. Just sat there at the bar watching everyone."
"Are you serious?"
Yale was simultaneously entertained by this, and aware of, grateful for, the distraction. Which is to say, he wasn't fully distracted.
"Why would he remember you?"
Richard cocked a shoulder, batted his eyes. 10 years ago, I was the belle of the ball." Yale waved him further into his office and whispered,
"Listen, is there any chance I could crash at your house tonight? Charlie's mother's in town, and she snores."
"Well, I have a date. We'll be making a lot more noise than Charlie's mother." Yale laughed, as if he'd only asked on a lark. Richard said,
"Are you all right? You look like hell."
He tried to make a humorous face. "She's a very loud snorer." The sun was setting and Bill had gone home. Yale pulled out both his scotch bottle and the Yellow Pages. There were hotels right near campus. He had about $800 in his checking account. A hotel would eat that up quickly, but he couldn't think about it right now. Someone rapped on his door, and he remembered Cecily, that certainly she'd be coming today to light into him. Didn't she always save him for the end of the day? This was the thing he'd been dreading most 2 days ago. And now it was nothing. He said, "Come in." Then he pulled 2 coffee mugs down from his bookshelf, and without even looking at her, he poured scotch into both. She stared for a long time at the mug he held out to her, and then she took it and sat down. She looked more drained than furious, and he felt suddenly terrible for her. He'd originally planned to call her in the morning, or better yet, to send a memo over, some kind of apology or heads up or both. But whatever his plans had been yesterday, they were dust under the freight train now. Cecily wore a yellow pantsuit that washed her out.
Her hair had gone limp. She said, "I suppose you know what I've been doing all day."
"How's Chuck?"
"Furious. Yale, it's not the money. Maybe your art is really worth $2 million, but the point is, there's fallout for me. He's got the new president's ear, and he's giving me a list of all the trustees he's going to complain to. They won't pull their bequests or anything, but it makes things very bad for me, for my job."
He said, "I really am sorry it turned out this way."
"I thought we were friends."
Yale could think of nothing to say.
And so he held out his own cup to click against hers.
He assumed his face was ravaged enough that she couldn't mistake this for celebration. She sipped her scotch and sank back.
"Plus, I'm sorry," she said. "But most of the trustees, they don't care about the art. They can't build a new fitness center with art. They can't give scholarships with art."
Yale said,
"The media will be all over this. Tell them we just made this gallery. In 5 years, they won't care."
He felt dizzy, glad to be sitting. Food. He'd forgotten food again.
"Am I correct?" Cecily said. And now she sounded sharper, less self-pitying. "In my understanding that you still don't even know if these pieces are authentic?"
Yale put his forehead on his desk, softly, because it was the only place his forehead could go. He said, "If they're not real, I'm the one who's getting fired, not you. Not Bill. If they're mad right now, just tell them to fire me. Blame it on me."
"Are you being passive-aggressive? What is this?"
"I'll quit if I have to, all right? I'll sign a thing. I'll tell them."
She said, "You don't seem okay, Yale."
"I'm about to pass out, Cecily. And I don't care about my job anymore. I want to go to sleep now. Can you leave?" There was a long pause, and then she said,
"No."
Later, he didn't quite remember them leaving his office, but he must have explained that yes, he meant that he wanted to sleep in his office, and no, he couldn't go home. He remembered walking down Davis Street, an arm around Cecily for support. She was telling him about her couch, that it pulled out, but might be more comfortable folded. The cold air had revived him enough by then that he was able to wonder if this was a terrible idea, if she'd again offer him cocaine and rub his thigh. But she was saying something about her son, how he'd already be home. The Door County behavior must have been the freak-out of a stressed single mother with the rare chance to misbehave. And if she hadn't gotten the message that he really was gay when he sat outside the Howard Brown party snotting up Fiona's shoulder, something was wrong with her. She said,
"Your feet must be freezing. Don't you have boots?"
"These were my lucky Door County shoes. They worked at first. My luck has turned." He was glad Cecily didn't press for details. Maybe she'd gotten the impression he was prone to tears and didn't want him melting down. She said,
"How do you feel about Chinese?"
His stomach responded before his head could. A tidal wave of hunger. He said, "It's on me, for putting you out." Cecily lived on the second floor, in a two-bedroom place with a living room half the size of Yale's office. Her son, Kurt, he's a latchkey kid, she'd said on the walk, was sprawled on the couch when they arrived, homework spread on the coffee table. He looked straight through Yale. Maybe Cecily brought a lot of men home and said,
"Mom, I finished my math for the whole weekend. Can I watch Miami Vice?" "This is Yale," she said. "He works with me."
"But can I? I'll go to bed at 9.
"We have a guest," she said.
Yale said, "I don't mind. I like that show." So after they ate, Yale scarfed down helping after helping of Mushu and Lo Mein, glad he'd paid for it. And after Yale had mindlessly asked Kurt about his classes and sports and friends, they sat and watched Don Johnson and his 5 o'clock shadow chase a smuggler around an eerily blue swimming pool. Kurt cheered as if it were a live sports match. This was how Yale needed to spend his days, if the next 3 months were going to pass with any speed. He needed to watch TV and go to movies,
mindless entertainment that would keep coming at him. No neurons left for hating Charlie, missing Charlie, obsessing over his own health. After Kurt went to bed, Yale pulled out the scotch again and Cecily brought two glasses from the kitchen, little red ones with white silhouettes of Greek athletes around the sides. He told her, in detail, what had happened. Because he needed to tell someone. And because she wasn't part of Charlie's circle. And because maybe it was an offering of sorts. Having ruined Cecily's life, he could at least lay his own ruined life on the table in front of her. She sat there nodding, nicely horrified at the worst parts. She was a good person. She showed no sign that she was thinking any more about her own job, her anger, her terrible day. He was developing a theory about Cecily. The hardness of her outer shell was only to protect a very soft core. Yale said, "I can leave if you want."
"Why would I want that?
I mean, you have a kid and everything. If I've been exposed to... you know." Cecily looked affronted.
"I don't imagine you're going to have sex with my son."
Then quickly,
"That was a joke."
"I know."
"I don't see how else it could be a problem. I'm fairly educated on the matter. I'm not worried about you sharing the orange juice."
Yale said, "Thank you. I can't believe you're being this good to me."
"Look, I know how I can come off. To get by in my job, as a woman, I have to be a certain way. But I genuinely like you."
She refilled his scotch, and he was glad. He said, "It's been a long time since I had a day that just cuts your life in two. Like, this hangnail on my thumb, I had it yesterday. It's the same hangnail, and I'm a completely different person." The scotch was helping him talk. He wasn't sure why he trusted Cecily, but he did. They'd done nothing but embarrass themselves in front of each other. Well, wasn't that how fraternities made kids bond? If they puked enough beer on each other, they were tethered for life. Cecily said,
"I've had days like that.
Nothing this bad, but before and after days." Yale didn't know what path Cecily's divorce had taken, but he imagined it was true.
"A change of scene is probably good. You're not around everything that reminds you. You know, if he'd walked out..."
"Right.
Then you're left with all his things."
Charlie was the one surrounded by Yale's things. Charlie was sitting on the bed they'd shared. And beside him was Yale's pillow. And in the closet were Yale's clothes. But Yale didn't feel pity. Just gratification. Let him be miserable. Let him hate himself as he publishes hypocritical articles about condom distribution. He couldn't quite get to let him be sick. Of course he didn't want that. Maybe he wanted Charlie to suffer before the doctors came back and said it was a false positive. He wanted him to worry for 6 months until the researchers suddenly announced a cure. He said to Cecily, "This disease has magnified all our mistakes. Some stupid thing you did when you were 19, the one time you weren't careful. And it turns out that was the most important day of your life. Like, Charlie and I could get past it if he just cheated. I'd probably never find out. Or we'd fight and make up. But instead an atom bomb went off. There's no one doing it." She said quietly,
"Doesn't he need you? I mean, when he gets sick, don't you think that might change things?"
"I could get sick before he does. This thing doesn't follow a predictable timeline. And if I do, I don't know that he's the one I want holding my hand."
"Fair enough."
It was something he hadn't known for sure until he said it aloud. Cecily said,
"You can stay as long as you need. A few days, a few weeks. Kurt could use a male figure around. Lord knows his father isn't much of one."
Before bed, he called home.
The first five times, there was no answer. The sixth, Teresa picked up. She said,
I'm sure you have much to say, Yale, but unless you're calling to smooth things over, this isn't the day.
No, I'm pretty sure it is. But he was slurring his words.
Today was hard enough already, and he's asleep.
He worried that if he waited, his anger wouldn't be at its peak. He needed to yell at Charlie now, not when he'd calmed down, had time to think. Except he wasn't calming down. Every few minutes, it would hit him fresh. Every few minutes, his blood pressure rose. The next day, Saturday, Yale went to the movies. He saw Spies Like Us and Out of Africa, but they weren't as distracting as he'd hoped. He was more absorbed with the people around him, the couples and teenagers and solo film buffs having perfectly normal days. He'd had thousands of normal days himself. It seemed such an alien concept now, to have a normal day. To walk around oblivious, just participating in the world. It seemed unreasonable for anyone to be allowed a normal day. That night he played Battleship with Kurt, and insisted on doing the dishes. As he scrubbed, Cecily said,
Do you want me to call my friend Andrew? He and his boyfriend were the ones I went to the Howard Brown thing with. He lost a lover, and he's a counselor now.
Thanks. I'm not ready. Yale could think of two Andrews, and wondered if this was one of them. Hadn't Andrew Parr lost someone? The outpopulation of Chicago had always been small enough as it was, and now they'd lost more than 100 men. And who knew how many they'd lose this year? Soon there would only be one gay Andrew left in the whole city. No last names needed. Even now, the odds that Cecily's Andrew knew Charlie were high. Yale said, I can't get my thoughts straight. I feel like my head is full of oil and vinegar, and someone's shaking it all up. Kurt, painting a model airplane at the table, said,
Your head is salad dressing.
Sure.
Salad head.
2015. Fiona met Arnaud outside the St. Paul Metro. He had the key to the building's front door already. And right around now, he hoped, the landlady would be unlocking Kurt's apartment. She'd call Arnaud to let him know it was done. He checked his messages. Nothing yet, but we have to walk anyway. Fiona had imagined them breaking into Kurt's in the middle of the night, or at least in the dark, but that made no sense. They had to do it when he and his wife were at work. And she had assumed this landlady would want to be present, to make sure they weren't stealing anything, but no, it was more important that she wasn't around to be implicated. Fiona looked at every face they passed, and it wasn't this time to find Claire. It was to check for Kurt, make sure she didn't have to duck behind Arnaud, pull her hair across her face. You need to calm down, Arnaud said. Huh, well, I'll try. The neighborhood was relatively swank at first, but slowly, as they walked, the streets, which were indeed full of both falafel places and rainbow flags, grew dingier. This side street in particular had what looked like either a sex club or peep show. She couldn't quite decipher the signs, but that was the gist. Arnaud stopped at a newsstand and bought Le Monde. He said, It's around the corner. While we wait, I'll buy you a whiskey.
It's not even 2 o'clock.
You need a whiskey to calm you down.
It's 1:54, she said,
but she followed him. Her painkiller was wearing off, and she was fighting this cold, and wasn't whiskey basically medicine? They found a cafe that was really more of a bar. Arnaud sat Fiona with a whiskey at a tiny round table in the corner. He read his paper and drank a beer, the foam sticking to his lip. This wasn't the worst thing.
She'd be less likely now to jump if the floorboards creaked, to shriek if she saw a spider. She held the glass with her left hand, kept her bandaged right hand in her lap. She still couldn't uncurl her fingers without sending white-hot pain up her arm. She was the one facing the windows, and she watched the sidewalk the whole time. At the only other occupied table, a couple argued quietly in French over their espressos. The man looked a good deal older than the woman, although what French woman between 15 and 50 didn't look 26? This is how she and Damien must first have appeared to the outside world. The young student and her professor. The 15-year gap just small enough that no one took them for father and daughter. And how could they? The way she used to hang on him. They'd been eating once on the top floor of the Edgewater Hotel in Madison, a place with windows looking out over Lake Mendota, bobbing docks and angry gulls. When Damien got up for the restroom, a white-haired man approached the table and in a thick, slobbery accent said, "You are the mistress, no?" Fiona had the presence of mind not to engage, not even to deny this. She just signaled the waiter, who came right over, and the man left. But she'd laughed about it with Damien for weeks. When she answered the phone, he'd say, "You are the mistress, no?" She wasn't. Damien had never been married, never even planned to get married until suddenly, that next fall, Fiona found herself pregnant. It was the start of her fourth year at Wisconsin, and she was 27. She said to Arnaud, "Can you just call the landlady?" "I tell you what, I'll call in 10 minutes, but we'll hear before then." She appreciated his confidence as much as she resented it. The couple at the other table, she realized, had switched to English. Odd, because they didn't speak it well.
"I pay for the flat," the man was saying. "I pay, and this is how you do?"
He glanced at Fiona, and she pretended to read the front of Arnaud's newspaper, just inches from her face. She imagined the man assumed they were French. Le Monde probably helped, and thought English would be the safer language for communicating his anger. The woman said,
"What am I supposed to spend my day? I should sit there?"
She looked frustrated, but defiant, too. Was she a kept woman? Something worse?
"Yes," he said. "You sit, you read a book, I don't care. You watch a film."
He had wild, thick eyebrows. He was furious. Arnaud had gone still, moved his paper to the side to get a better look. Fiona wanted to write the woman a note.
Leave him now.
But there was no way to get it to her without the man noticing. Had someone seen Claire and Kurt like this in Boulder and done nothing? Had anyone seen Claire and the other Hosanna women walking together on a rare trip to town, arms covered, faces down? Did anyone ask if they were all right? If they needed a ride to the airport and $300? The woman was crying, and Fiona managed to make eye contact with Arnaud, who gave a small shrug. The man picked up his own half-empty glass and poured his remaining water into the woman's. He checked that the waiter had his back turned, and then he wiped the glass with his napkin and shoved it into the woman's purse. The woman whispered in French, a protest, and he whispered back. Was this how they furnished her apartment? One pilfered dish at a time? The woman stood, miserable, and picked up her purse. They left quickly.
"Wow,"
Fiona said. Her whiskey was gone. Arnaud folded the paper, shook his head.
"Some women are very stupid."
"Excuse me? What, you think she's a genius?"
"You don't know what it's like to be with someone manipulative."
Though really, she didn't know either. Damien had been older, sure, and he often turned professorial, lecturing and pontificating, but he never manipulated her. Damien had supported her finishing school that year after the baby was born. and when Fiona had class, she'd drop Claire off with a bottle at his office, where she was the little princess of the sociology department. She'd come back 2 hours later to find the room full of grad students cooing over Claire, holding a rattle for her. Damien was never anything but solicitous. The marriage's failure was her fault entirely. She'd offered once that if any new girlfriend called her up, she'd testify to his character, explain how she was the one with commitment issues, how her heart was too battered for anything like real love. When he got together with Karen, Fiona had repeated the offer. "It's okay," he said. "She knows." Arno said, "I see this all the time. What do you think I investigate? Half of it involves, okay, not-so-genius women in trouble with a man. I turn down jobs every week from guys like that who want women followed." Fiona told herself not to yell at Arno, whose assistance she didn't want to lose. She said, "I've known men in that situation, too. Men manipulated by women, or by other men." Arno looked at his phone. She texted. "Oh," she said. "Okay. Okay." And suddenly she was all nerves again. She tipped the chair back, getting up, had to grab the table's edge, nearly tipped that over as well. Under other circumstances, it might have been an adventure. Watching for neighbors, scampering inside. But it was terrifying, nauseating. In the worst case, they'd find something horrible. Fiona didn't believe Kurt would hurt Claire. But did you ever know a thing like that? She remembered something her own mother had told her one of the last times they'd really talked, right before Nico died. Fiona had been blaming her for not standing up to her husband, for letting him kick Nico out. They were in the hospital cafeteria. Her mother said, "You'll never know anyone's marriage but your own. And even then, you'll only know half of it." The apartment was dingy and poorly furnished. A dead rat-in-the-wall smell, rotting sweet. A big, divided room with an unmade bed at one end, a threadbare blue couch at the other. A small kitchen area. Two empty bowls in the sink. Arno had made her promise not to touch anything. And so she stood helpless, in the middle of the place, turning circles as he explored. "The other closet is coats," Arno announced. "But this one is dresses." He stood at an open door near the bed. "You recognize any?" If she did, they'd have to be from Claire's freshman year or earlier. She'd completely given up on the idea that Claire lived here with Kurt. But it couldn't be ruled out. Maybe the woman with dark hair was just someone Kurt was having an affair with. She stood at Arno's side and peered in. Pastel colors, which Claire hated. Nothing familiar. But there were sundresses and cocktail dresses in here. Not Hosanna clothes. Arno held a whole dress out from the rack, the way you would at a store. "Way too long to be Claire's," she said. This thing would drag on the floor. And there were no toys around. No child's bed. There were bills for Kurt Pierce on the small coffee table, and an empty greeting card envelope addressed to a Marie Pierce. "Marie? She could be French," Fiona said. "Sure. Could be from New Zealand for all we know." Fiona looked in the bathroom. A medicine cabinet missing a door. Nothing abnormal inside. No antipsychotic drugs. Vitamins, ointments. A packet of birth control pills. The Hosanna did not believe in those. To the right of the sink, a photo of a little girl had been tacked up in a plastic sleeve. Oh, God. About 3 years old. It had to be the girl from the video. Had to. Fiona felt something like an allergic reaction, tight in her throat, her chest, even as she wanted to sing, to grab Arno and waltz him around the apartment. Golden curls, eyes like Nico's. not much like Claire herself, who'd resembled Damien even as a child. Wan, glowering, lips thin and tight. When Damien was her sociology professor, Fiona had imagined his face suggested soul, a life of wisdom dearly earned. She'd never imagined it might come down to genes. But this little girl, she was a Marcus. Nico's hair had started blonde, had grown dark right as he sprang up tall, right as his voice dropped. Fiona grew suddenly shy around him that year, didn't know how to relate to this strange, giant boy. And really, she never learned again how to be his sister, because within a year or two she'd turned into his accomplice, his thief, his occasional mother. This child. If you cut her hair, if you dressed her in the boy clothes of the 1960s, she was Nico. With just her good left hand, Fiona pulled out the tack and drew the photo from its sleeve. There was nothing on the back. She wanted to take it, but she couldn't do that. "Look," she said to Arnaud. He grabbed it by the edges and said, "Ta-ta-ta-ta-ta! Don't get fingerprints!" Well, what had he been doing touching everything then? He laid the photo on the bed and took a picture of it. He said, "It's impossible not to get a spot of light. Will you send me a copy?" "Sure," he said. "Sure." They didn't find much else. Arnaud said, 10 years ago we'd be looking for an address book. Not so easy anymore." He opened the cupboard above the stove, rifled through boxes and cans. "What do you think of this?" He held out a brown cereal box on which a cartoon rabbit leaned over a bowl of chocolate flakes. Chocapic, it was called. The box bragged, "C'est fort en chocolat." "Maybe for the little girl?" "Well," Fiona said. She didn't want to let herself get too excited. A man who lived in an apartment like this, she thought, might eat those for dinner. But then she remembered that Kurt had always been a health nut, that the Hosanna Collective believed in biblical grains. He might have left the cult, but it would be odd to rediscover chocolate cereal in your 40s. She opened the refrigerator, and although there wasn't much, it was health food. Plain yogurt, bottled green drinks, what seemed to be the French version of tofurkey. "Expires next spring," Arnaud said, still looking at the box. "It can't be so old. That's good, yeah?" The cereal did reignite some small hope, but she didn't want to admit it. Arnaud took more photos. Fiona sensed it was for show. What good would a picture of the sink do? As they left, she fought the impulse to leave something deliberately askew, to bump a lamp or scrawl a question mark on the wall. "We were never here," Arnaud said. He turned the lock and closed the door behind them. "Goodbye, Kurt Pierce's flat." Fiona wandered the Marais a long time, feeling awkwardly American here where there weren't as many tourists. She showed Claire's photo, with slightly renewed optimism, to waiters, to shopkeepers. She showed it to a scraggy-haired man waiting on a corner with a long, narrow box. He turned out to be a Brit. Then she was fairly sure he was stoned. He looked at the picture a long time, and then he said, "Not everyone wants to be found." Fiona walked away insulted, and didn't feel like talking to anyone else. She circled back too close to Kurt's apartment. Here was the place she'd had the whiskey earlier. She stopped to use the bathroom, feeling she had more right to do so here than elsewhere. When she emerged, she hoped she'd see the fighting couple out on the street. Really, she hoped she'd see just the woman, alone, leaning against a window and crying. Fiona would wrap her up, take her back to Richard's. She could save one woman, even if it was the wrong woman. But the street was, as she'd known it would be, empty.
1986. Sunday was the day. Charlie would be working, even if he'd taken Friday off. Out Loud published on Monday.